You're listening to the 21st Century Change Agent Show. This podcast is for those who are always looking for ways to grow as a person and as a leader. On this show, you'll find no ordinary conversations, as I will be speaking with unique people who are already rewriting the narrative. My name is Barbara Ziga, and I help companies to achieve more by putting their people first. Head to Lake House Consulting website to find out more and to subscribe to a bite-sized, hand-picked newsletter from me. Thank you for tuning in and get ready to receive your weekly dose of inspiration. Hello, all the beautiful people, and thank you for joining me for another Change Agent podcast episode. This one is an extra special one, as my guest today is a transgender woman, Celia Daniels, who very openly shared her story as part of the LGBTQ plus History Month here in the UK. The word transgender or trans is an umbrella term for people whose gender identity is different from the sex assigned to them at birth. Although the word transgender and our modern definition of it only came into use in the late 20th century, people who would fit under this definition have existed in every culture throughout recorded history. The trans community is incredibly diverse. Some trans people identify as trans men or trans women, while others might describe themselves as non-binary, genderqueer, gender non-conforming, agender, bigender, and other identities that reflect their unique personal experiences. Some take hormones or have surgery and transition medically, while others may change pronouns and appearance and transition socially. According to English Heritage, individuals throughout history have lived radical private lives outside the accepted sexual and gender norms of the time. However, LGBTQ history is often hidden from the view. Expression of same-sex love and gender nonconformity has been constrained by both repressive social attitudes and criminal persecution. While transgender people are increasingly visible in both popular culture and in daily life, they still face severe discrimination, stigma, and systematic inequities. Some of the specific issues facing the trans community are lack of legal protection, poverty, stigma and discrimination, violence, lack of healthcare coverage, and others. Anti-discrimination laws in most US cities and states, for instance, do not protect transgender people from discrimination based on gender identity or gender expression. And therefore, transgender people experience high levels of discrimination in employment, housing, healthcare, education, legal systems, and even their families. To help me unpack this topic in more detail, today I'm joined by Celia Daniels, who is a transgender woman, an all-round beautiful soul, and you will get to experience this yourself as you listen to this episode and episode following this one next week when we will continue our conversation. Celia and I had over 2-hour-long conversation about her journey of living in a closet and eventually coming out, being transgender in the corporate America, building family and finding acceptance within herself and her community. And I felt it was important for her story to be told and heard in full as part of the LGBTQ plus History Month in the UK, the upcoming International Women's Day, and as part of everyday conversations, as these conversations need to be normalised. On this episode, I felt privileged to simply hold space for Celia to tell her story. As heartfelt and liberating as I found it, I also have to warn you that some of the content covered, some people might find upsetting and trigger trauma, as we will touch on such elements as sexual harassment and self-harm. If you do experience any of these, I have added some resources and organizations to speak to in the show notes. Thank you for joining us today, and here is my conversation with Celia Daniels. Right, Celia, thank you so much for coming on the show. It is great to have you here today.
Oh, thank you so much, Baba. I'm so happy to be here.
So before we dive into our exciting conversation, which I know we will have today, I would love if you could just tell us a little bit more about your journey from being a child in India to becoming a globally known human and trans rights activist.
Yeah, that's thank you so much for emphasizing a little bit on the global side, because you know I was born in India and I've lived half my life in India and half my life in US. But I will go and I will talk a little bit about my childhood days, because it has a very deep connection to what I'm doing today. So my name is Celia Cynthia Daniels, and I go by she and they pronouns. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm a dad. I'm a husband of a beautiful cisgender woman. I am a musician. I am an artist. I am a public speaker. I have so many identities that I really love to talk about. But when they look at Celia Daniels, the only thing they remember is, oh, Celia, you're trans. So I wanted to, in this podcast, talk a little bit about my intersectional identities as well, because it really matters as a human being what you're bringing to the whole community and to the corporate world. So I grew up in India in the early 70s. When I was a child, probably around 4 years old, I knew I was different, and I told my mom that I wanted to be a girl because that's the only way I knew how to express myself. My mom looked at the social constructs of the colonial British government that was so binary at the time, and she said, it's very cute that you're playing in a sari, and you know, she just let me play with it. Till I was probably around 6 or 7 years old, she told me that, you cannot wear those clothes anymore because you are a boy. And that's the time my gender kind of hit me that, oh, I cannot be wearing a skirt and also try to be a boy. You know, it's not possible. I have to pick one of them. And the social constructs were so tight and so much, I would say, a man's world. The patriarchy was pretty high at the time that I started suppressing my femininity, and I was just learning to survive as a child. So yeah, that's the way my journey started in India. I had gone through so many, I would say, challenges while I was growing up. One of them I want to talk about, and especially this could trigger some warnings for people who are sensitive. I just wanted to give you some trigger warnings in some of my first 5 minutes of conversation. So when I was a child, when I was growing up, I was going through a lot of trauma, which I did not understand what it was at the time, because I wanted to be a boy and I was just longing to be a girl. You know, I was battling between two genders. It was very unique at the time. I didn't understand, but I liked girls a lot. I'm not attracted to boys. I was only attracted to girls. And I was so attracted that I wanted to be a girl, which is very, funny. And even at that point, I didn't understand what I was going through. I didn't know that I was going through a gender identity issue and not a sexual orientation issue. Because at the time, if a boy was attracted to a boy, they knew the person was gay. But I wasn't, and I didn't know where to categorize my own life. But I didn't understand any of that. And I slowly was not willing to come out as a girl because it was such a patriarchal community and men were always known, women were second citizens in India at the time. And it was a male-dominated community. And I had the privilege of being a boy and I had all the, I was enjoying it. At the same time, I wanted to be a girl too, and I was struggling between those genders. I remember one time growing up in a conservative Christian family, my parents they wanted me to go to church and be a good person. At the same time, the more and more I went to church, the more and more I learned about God and Bible, I was also scared because I thought my life was not good enough for God. So that was the second trauma that I was going through. One was the mental trauma that I was going through, which was more on a gender dysphoria. The second was more of a lack of faith or a lack of trust in the religion that was in my family. And I didn't know what to do. So that was another trauma that was adding a second layer. The third layer, which I wanted to talk about growing up as a child, was my uncle molested me when I was 4 years old. In the fourth grade. I didn't know how to react to it. And I was thinking that it's because of me. I just took the blame on myself rather than telling my mom that, hey, this is what happened. I was so ashamed. And I was so filled with shame already as a boy who wanted to be a girl. And then this kind of another layer of shame was added on top of it, which I didn't know what to do. So I just sucked it up and I said, you know what? I'm just going, it's okay. I think he didn't mean it. It's me. I'm wrong. And I just went on for 2 years. And then my cousin brother, he molested me. And that's the time it hit me as to what was really going on in my life. You know, why are these people doing that to me? I didn't understand. I still kept blaming myself. But at a point, I said, I'm never going to talk about it. This never happened. It's just me. Maybe I wasn't, you know, completely raped. I'm okay with it, whatever happened. So that's okay. You know, unfortunately, the reason why I'm bringing these words is because in India, there's a lot of culture, rape culture, even today. There's such a lot of massive discrimination that happens with women in the remote parts and also in certain sectors in the cities. The point where I was going to was I felt like my existence was difficult. I couldn't even live another day, and every day was a struggle. I was trying to be a boy, and I wanted to prove to the world that I was a boy, so I get kind of tuned in my masculinity. I played all games and sports that were more male-dominated, like cricket and field hockey, volleyball. I did a lot of things which I wanted to prove to people that I was a boy. I was waking up every morning and I would think, if I do this, then people won't suspect me. My friends won't suspect me. If I do this, they may suspect me. That's the kind of, you know, the trauma that I was going through. And I did not know how to put it in words. But I just was very selective in what I did. And I was wearing my mom's petticoats and my grandmom's petticoats also during the time because I was a little child. And I was in a closet. I was living a closeted life. I remember in my 9th grade, that's the first time I decided to go out and be myself. So I dressed up in a long skirt and a pink top, and I covered my head with a scarf, like a hijab, the Muslim women wear. And I walked outside. It was dusk that evening. It was a beautiful evening. The wind was blowing on my skirt and my face, and I felt so alive at the time. I was so alive, and I was feeling that, wow, this is so beautiful to be myself. I was walking through the streets. It was a little bit dark. And I was walking through a construction site. When I came to the construction site, the security person in that construction site, he caught hold of me and he said, what are you doing here? You know, why are you walking through the construction site? And as I started talking to him, he noticed that I was a boy. And he immediately started yelling. And it was more like a fun yelling. It was like, oh my God, you know, this is a boy, and this is a hijra boy. He mentioned that in Tamil, and he started making all this noise, and a lot of people joined me, and they started standing and publicly humiliating me for like 15-20 minutes. There were a lot of people who surrounded me that day, and I didn't know how to react because I thought that's probably the end of my life, because when you get caught as a trans person, they can do whatever they want to you. And nobody would question, because you're the scum of the society. You're not needed by the society. And nobody would even care, and people won't bother. And I was so scared at the time because I didn't want my parents to go through the shame that I was going through. I stood there for a while and I was thinking to myself, why are they so angry at me? I didn't rob, I didn't steal, I didn't do anything wrong, but why are they so angry? And that's the first time in my life I've ever faced discrimination firsthand and hate. And that hate was so much like a violent hate. I wasn't sure if I would even make it back then that night. And I was, you know, for some reason, I just spoke in another language and I asked some questions and I distracted them and I ran away from that place. They didn't follow me, but I came back home and I said to myself that I am planning to, I can't live my life this way, and I need to kill myself. So I started thinking about, you know, how do I kill myself? I started attempting suicide in different ways. I started choking myself, and I was doing a lot of self-harm. I was so unhappy. I went to the beach. I used to go to the beach and cry all the time. And my therapy was the open skies and the beach and the horizon. I used to say, God, why did you make me like this? Change me. And that was the way my childhood days were. All my schooling was that way. And when I got to college, I did well. I did my master's in computer science. I worked in a great company. I joined a good company and was working there. I worked in research firms, in life sciences research firms, in crystallography labs, and I was working on a human genome project that came to India at the time, the first human genome project. I was working with my professor in the crystallography lab, and I was looking at the DNA molecules and the analysis that I was doing on the protein synthesis that we are doing. And I was thinking to myself, is there some information in DNA that tells me that I'm trans? Is there some information, or am I just making it up? Is there a science to why a boy would want to be a girl? Or am I the only unique person on earth? And I didn't know how to react to it, and I was always looking for an answer. While I was in my job and while I was working in India, I got married. It was an arranged marriage. And I didn't want to tell my wife at the time, my fiance at the time, because I thought I would get over this. It's some kind of a fetish, you know, I can overcome it. And that's how I thought. I got married to this beautiful girl, and she was a cisgender woman, and I loved her, and I never wanted to talk about any of my femininity. So we got married, and I was sent to US on a job work that I was supposed to be doing here for JP Morgan Chase in New York. I came here and I was working with these companies. I was flying globally. I was also working between New Jersey and New York. I was commuting. And while I was doing all that, I was professionally successful while personally I was dying and decaying inside. My wife joined me a little later, and I, the 1 year of our marriage was fantastic. And it was just amazing. And just after that, my drive, my gender dysphoria started coming even more. It was pretty intense. I remember the time I was with my wife, and I used to think, oh my God, I want to be her. It was so funny. And I used to think, I really want to be her, and I don't know why I cannot. I want to tell her what I'm going through. Is she going to dislike me, or am I going to confuse her? I don't want to confuse her. You know, she's miles apart from her family, and I don't want her to get into any kind of confusion. That's how I was always trying to be very considerate to my wife, and I really loved my wife. And I had a child 3 years after we got married. And even I wasn't even sure that I would have a child, because in my mind, I always had this notion that trans people cannot have children. I don't know what kind of myth that was, but when I had my daughter, I was so happy, and I was thinking to myself that finally my femininity is going to go away because I can have a child. I'm a man. I'm not a woman. And I was always battling and living in denial even after that time, even after I had my child. But one night after 5 years of a marriage, I could not take it. I was just lying to my wife, and I was just pretending that I was okay. It was probably 11:30 in Florida. I was, my wife was almost partly asleep, and I went and told her, sweetheart, I'm going through an issue. And I told her everything that I was going through. And she said, I don't know what to say, but why don't you go to a therapist? Because I don't know, maybe there's some kind of a fetish, you know, men dress like women, and there are drag queens, there are performers. I don't know what you are. Maybe you just like it, but you know, you're not a trans person. And I believed her. I spoke to a therapist, and the therapist told me that I was a confused gay. I didn't know how to put a finger on it, because to me that was confusing already. And then when you are called gay, and I told him, no, I'm not interested in men, and why are you calling me as gay? And he said, no, I've seen people like you, and I know you're probably one of them. And I didn't want to meet that therapist again. So I just kind of said, you know, these people have no idea what I'm going through. And I said, let me just be a cross-dresser, because I was afraid to have surgery and I didn't want to go to that extent. So I just chose this path of being just a cross-dresser. So those days, I think even in early 2000 that I know, when I was in this country, it was always about either you're a cross-dresser or you are a transsexual. And those were the terminologies used. But now the terminologies have changed. It's everyone who doesn't identify in the gender you're born, you're called as transgender. And when you, and people like transsexuals are actually called the post-op trans. And I was not even interested in hormones at the time, because I don't know if I want to, if I hated my male gender, my birth gender, which was at the time. And even today, you know, I've never transitioned, and I didn't want to, because of a reason that was the fact that I didn't hate my birth gender, but I wanted to be my chosen gender, which was my feminine gender. I felt like I wanted to amplify both of my genders rather than just moving from one gender to the other. And I started navigating my life that way, which was very interesting, because I didn't know what was going on. And I said, if people don't understand what I'm going through, maybe I should start doing my own research. So I started doing research. I started studying about myself, and I didn't find too many articles at the time. But I found so many research papers from Stanford Medical, from Johns Hopkins, a few research from European academic institutes. You know, there were a lot of research and a lot of articles that I was reading at the time. And I started educating myself. And the more and more I read, I felt like I wasn't alone. And I started thinking about, how do I go out and meet people? And because I was always going to the bars and finding acceptance in the wrong place. The more I went to the bars and I was looking at acceptance and I was looking at confirmation from people saying that, oh, you pass like a woman, or you look like a woman, it made me so happy. But I was living in an infatuated world, which was not something that I wanted to. I didn't want to just pass as a woman, but I wanted to be present as a woman and make a difference, or a trans woman. I knew I wasn't a cisgender woman, but I wanted to be a trans woman, and I want the world to know that I'm a trans woman, which was very unique. You know, people always try to pass like a woman. So I had some passing privileges at the time, but I did not like it at a point, because I wasn't standing up for myself. I was just passing and I was hiding to the world, and I did not like it more, because the more and more I did that, it looked like I wasn't being myself. I was always pretending like a somebody whom I wasn't. I then came out in my community. I met a lot of folks in the LGBT community. I started talking to the medical. I went to the medical conferences. I went to a lot of places, and where I started educating myself about the trans community. Conferences, seminars, and some folks who have already done research in this area. I wanted to, since I had a life sciences background, I wanted to know more and more. And that created a lot more curiosity as to why should I transition if I would do the same thing even if I transition. And I thought to myself, as I'm going through a lot of medical complications already, and do I really need to transition? So I came out in my community as a person who had non-op trans, or a person who has not transitioned, or a gender non-binary. This was in 2011. Unfortunately, people in my community and even the trans folks at the time said that, Celia, you're just a cross-dresser. Only if you transition, you can be medically transitioned, you can be a true, authentic transgender person. And I told them that, look, I'm married. I have a beautiful daughter and a lovely wife, and I don't want this kind of life. But I was being put in a box again, you know, stereotyped even within the transgender community, that if you come out, this is what you need to do. Start taking HRT, start taking, you know, do a facial feminization surgery and move on to electrolysis and everything that you need to do, and then you can transition medically. And that was always a conversation that I heard, and it always scared me because I really loved my wife and my daughter. And I was thinking that I don't want to be another woman in my house because I wanted to be a dad to my daughter. I wanted to be a husband to my wife. But at the same time, I wanted to be Celia too. It was really hard, and I was struggling, and I was thinking, well, is my marriage going to fall apart if I transition? And why do I need to transition? If my wife can accept me, then it'll be okay. So I started educating my wife and my daughter about what I was going through. And my daughter accepted me in 25 minutes. And this is when she was 15 years old. I think it's the fact that because they are very open, they see the world in a different lens than what my wife was seeing. My wife is close to my age, and she was always looking at it from a very conservative perspective. She was born and brought up like myself in a Christian community, which was very conservative. And, you know, she said, is this wrong? Is this what God wants you to do? And we had all those Christian conversations while I was talking to her about my medical issues. I told her, sweetheart, if God made me this way, then I'm this way. I can't help it. And nobody wakes up and says that I want to choose this life. You know, I didn't want this life. I have never wanted this life because it is really hard. You go through a lot of stress. You go through gender dysphoria, which kind of kills you. You know, you're going through depression all the time. You're feeling sad. You're feeling like you're missing something all the time. You feel like there's a white noise in your head all the time that keeps on telling you that it's not you. It's not you. You know, whatever you're doing, that's not you. And I don't know what to do. And I was struggling, and I told her, sweetheart, this is my life. Nothing is going to change. And while I was trying to convince my wife, and now she's my biggest ally and a great friend, we are still married. You know, it's been 23 years. This April will be 24 years. And I'm so proud of, it took a lot of time, but I'm really proud of my wife for understanding me and accepting me the way I am. It took a while, and I think I'm blessed to have such a wonderful family, my wife and my daughter. They are my biggest allies now, and my daughter is so supportive. You know, she's going to be in a podcast with me talking about how her dad is still a trans and how, you know, we are navigating through our family circumstances as a family, as a unit. I think these stories need to be heard because it's not always about medical transition. Sometimes you can be who you are, just the way you are, gender non-binary. And that is the part of my life that I wanted to emphasize, that it's more important for us in a family unit to have that understanding, have that sacrifice. I learned to sacrifice a few things for my family. And my wife sacrificed a few things for me. My daughter sacrifices a few things for me. And we try to live together because we all love each other. We sometimes have, it's not about what I think is right or what she thinks is right. So we have learned to adjust our life in such a way that we can all live together and be happy about something, you know, if you don't. So it was, I really enjoy, I'm so blessed to talk about that today. Coming to the corporate world, that's a whole new discussion. When I was talking about the fact that I came to this country in early 1997, I was working in New York. I was working for healthcare and life sciences company, and I was an executive. I started doing really well. I grew up in my ranks. I started delivering a lot of P&L. I had global teams, and I was focusing so much on my work because I didn't want to be Celia. You know, there were times when I started putting my attention on being that man part of it. I wanted to amplify my masculinity so that I could kind of play down on Celia. But after a business presentation, I would go to my hotel room, and I would just change into a maxi dress, and I would sit down in my room quietly and cry, and I would say, God, my life is so difficult. I want to be a man, and at the same time, I want to be a girl. Is there a way there can be some kind of a compromise in both? You know, can I live both my lives together? Unfortunately, the world wasn't ready for it at the time. And I always wanted to do this. And I was scared to come out in my company because I was an executive at the time. I was managing the West Coast for life sciences, and I was doing managing a P&L close to $250 million. There were a lot of things that I did professionally, and I was very successful. I've got awards from the customers. I was good with customers. I was good with people. I was very good in what I did. But unfortunately, I was struggling inside. And I remember the last company that I was working in, a corporate firm, it was one of the top five consulting firms, Capgemini. I remember coming out in Capgemini, and I felt like I was not being heard. You know, though I came out as gender non-binary or gender fluid, I wasn't heard. It was more like, oh, why don't you come in a dress tomorrow? You know, we want to see you in a sari. You look so cute. You know, those kind of conversations did not help me. It was kind of objectifying who I am rather than just understanding what I was going through. And I kind of felt like maybe the corporate world is not ready for me and I need to think about it. So I just did not want to come out in those companies, and I quit Capgemini. I took a break for a while. I went to nonprofits and I started working with nonprofits, and I got involved in so many community activities. I remember coming out in my community at the time as Celia, and I was fighting for transgender rights, and that was important to me in healthcare and incarceration, homelessness. Every area of the ecosystem around the trans community was being compromised. So the children were being bullied at school because of the issues they were going through. To me, that mattered a lot because I wanted to change the younger generation. I wanted to see how I can change. So I started telling my story. And in 2015, I came out with my story in the local newspaper. And instead of people accepting at the time, this was just before Caitlyn Jenner came out, instead of people just accepting who I am, they started making fun of me and they started discriminating and hating me. This is in my own community. They said, you're a man in a dress who needs medical help. You're just, either you transition or you just, you know, pretend to be who you are. And I thought to myself, you know, this is something that's going to happen. I have to be an advocate for myself. I need to defend myself because there's no one else that's going to stand up for me. So I started standing up for myself. And while I did that, and I was thinking that, can I do something being Celia? Can I do something more? Not just for transgender rights, but can I just stand up for my friends? My Muslim friends are getting beaten because of the religion and people misunderstanding them. My Sikh friends in the BIPOC community. I also looked around and I saw the African-American community, the Black community being persecuted. And I said, can I do something about it? I want to learn because I have a lot of transgender friends and they have lost their lives. A lot of them were I think last year around 34 of them were killed and murdered because, and a lot of them are people of color, just because they are trans. And I said, I want to save a life. I want to save the lives of trans people. What can I do? So the first thing I learned was I started educating myself. I started learning to tell my story. And I started looking at these organizations. It could be police department. It could be school board. It could be a democratic club. It could be a college. I've spoken in all these venues. And while I was doing that, my heart was back in India. That's the country I came out. I mean, I tried coming out. So I went back to India and I started working with some activists in India as well. I work with an organization called Sahodari Foundation. And my dear friend, Dr. Kalki Subramaniam, I collaborated with her. And she was doing a phenomenal work in India, even changing the policies at the national level. So Kalki is a great advocate, and I was so happy that my life was, you know, I could do something useful from the country that was hating me. They hated me. And I said, you know what, though they have a third gender, they really don't understand. They just sympathize with you. They just tolerate you. They don't really empathize. They don't want to empower you. And that's when I said, I'm a corporate executive and I want to come out in India. Can people accept me? And I started telling my story in India, and everyone said, you are so well educated, and why do you want to come out? You know, why do you want to be like the Hijra people here? And I said, they are the ones who got kicked out from the families. If the parents would have accepted, they won't be in the street. I hid my life. I didn't want to come out in my family because I knew I would end up like them. And I was scared to come out. I didn't have the courage to do it. But my parents, they didn't know anything that I was going through. Now I am out. So that's what I started doing in India. And I still continue to help the organizations in India. I started talking in some of the panels in India with KPMG and a few other organizations, with Goldman Sachs. Whenever I got a chance to speak globally, I started doing it. And I found a lot of change. And in a nutshell, today I started my own company and I do consulting for healthcare and life sciences. I am still consulting and I can still be a gender non-binary person. And I can go a little bit detail in terms of what companies are really doing to advance the trans rights from the bathroom to the boardroom. I have questioned HRC. I've questioned a lot of companies that are just pink washing, and in a nice way. And I told them that, you know, I can help you. And now I'm on the executive board for Trans Can Work. This is an organization that empowers companies and educates them to hire more trans and gender non-binary individuals in the workplace. I'm proud to be a part of this organization that because I'm making a difference, not just in my life, but also in the lives of trans entrepreneurs, trans professionals, and trans job seekers who want jobs and they want a dignified life. Nobody wants to be in a sex work or be begging in the streets. So I want to change that. And if there's something that I can do, I wanted to do. And I started doing it. I started being a part of a community activist and making changes at the policy level. I worked with Trans Latino Coalition in LA and brought in some recommendations in changing the transgender ecosystem for the policies in California. How can we influence the change and how can we make sure that the younger generation can have a better life? And that's my focus all the time. Though I was always thinking about the transgender community, I am now focusing more on the younger generation because a lot of the children are able to come out because we are of people like me, you know, and people like us who are already there and who are baby boomers or, you know, Gen Y, Gen X, whatever. But we are setting a trend. We are setting a pathway. We are building roads for the younger generations so they can have a better life. And that's what I want to do going forward in my life. This is not a lifestyle choice. I did not choose this lifestyle. This is who I am. This is my life. This is our life. And I want people to know that we don't choose this life to just hang out or this is not a trend. This is not something that everybody's coming out. What happened? What is going on in the world? This is a 4,000-year-old culture. Being gender fluid is almost like 4,000 to 7,000-year-old culture in India. It's nothing new. It's just that people are waking up and seeing the different facets of life. History repeats itself. So when history repeats itself, when these are various mythologies and what happened in India, in so many cultures that you can see across the world, there are people who are gender non-binary. There are human beings who are different. We have close to 7.5 billion people on the planet. Everybody has a unique thumbprint. Everyone is different. Why can't we be different as a human being in the gender spectrum? Now, that is a question that I started asking with my science knowledge. And I went back to the scientific community and I started talking and everybody understands that now. I even educated my doctor about gender dysphoria. I explained to him what it is. And I don't want to do this next time because I don't want doctors to be educated by the patients. It's so unfortunate, you know. But unfortunately, that's how it is. Right now, my doctor didn't get it. And I told him about it. And he said, oh, it's some kind of an anxiety. And I said, no, it's kind of not anxiety, but that's what you're born with. And but we are making a change now. And I think these stories need to be heard. And we need to change our community, our country, our world.
Celia, thank you so much for sharing this story. Your story is beautiful, it's heartfelt, it's profound, it's tough, but at the same time, it's also very liberating. And it's liberating, I think, for a lot of communities to hear, and not only LGBT community who might, or trans community who might relate to you in a very different way, but in terms of not being understood, not being accepted, being an immigrant, you know, all of those intersections, I think everyone can find something in your story to really relate to. But I guess the unfortunate thing for you is that you went through all of it at the same time, and you still are. But at the same time, as you said, you know, I think you certainly are a role model for those younger generations, and you really are paving the way for them. And so it is, you know, a very beautiful story. So thank you for sharing. And especially as you were talking, I was thinking about when you were talking about the affirmation and about being accepted. And being accepted is such a huge part of this journey, being accepted personally, so you accept yourself, being accepted by family, society, institution, and even trans community, by the sounds of it from your story, you know, as every of these bodies and structures have certain artificial standards about what you have to be, what you have to look like, what moderations you have to go through to belong. So I think throughout this journey, you know, probably your and I don't want to put, you know, words in your mouth anyway, but probably your sense of belonging has been really messed up, hasn't it, in many ways, probably from more from more conservative places, but I'm sure you found sense of belonging in very different places on the journey.
Absolutely. Yeah, it takes a while. I mean, I think when you, you know, you need to find who you are. And that's what I did. I started being right from a childhood. I call it as five dimensions of my story. When I call it as, you know, while I was a child, I was dreaming. And then I was doubting. And then I was discovering. Sorry, I was in denial. The third, and the fourth is then I started discovering what my life is going to look like. And the fifth one, which I am right now going through, is a destiny. I know this is my destiny. You know, I've chosen that. So there are five dimensions to my story. And I keep talking about this because you always try to find a sense of belonging in where you are. And sometimes you don't find it in the world. The world doesn't tell you where you are. You know, people like me, it's like, hey, you that you're there, you know, you're here. Even in one of my job interviews, the recruiter looked at me and said, you look like a girl, don't come out as a gender non-binary. You know, you don't have to, you just look like a girl. You know, you don't have to tell them you're trans. And I was like, no, that's wrong. I don't want you to give me a pass here. You know, unfortunately, that's what it is, because they want, when you stand in front of them, it looks like I'm standing in front of the entire world, and the world is just trying to understand me in their own way. They want to just pick and choose and try to say, okay, you're just this one, you're this one, you're this one. I'm going to, you know, and that's your identity. And I'm telling the world that, no, that's not how you look at world, you know, at any person, because you're just stereotyping based on what you can understand. If it's your limited knowledge, if facts don't fit into the framework of your mind, you start creating your own, which is wrong. I think those are, you rightly said, belonging was so hard.
Yeah, and exactly that piece where you talked about when people are creating their own alternative narratives just to fill in the void of what they don't understand. You know, if we go back, you know, millennia, you know, when there was thunderstorms outside, people were saying, you know, the God is angry with us and this is God's anger upon us, right? Because they didn't know that there was such thing as thunder or lightning or anything like that. So they tried to explain it through those narratives. And today, you know, people, when they don't understand, you know, any aspect of the intersection, you know, and you know, or transgender in this particular case, they just are trying to fill in the void for themselves, to make themselves feel comfortable, rather than asking those questions and doing the research and trying to understand. They're just filling the void with artificial narratives.
Absolutely, yeah. I think that's where it's so important for folks to educate themselves, and even the companies, wherever, even the community, they need to educate themselves on what's going on. I can talk a little bit about allyship later in the conversation. Mm-hmm. But it's if you want to know about anybody, any community, you need to first accept and acknowledge the fact that, you know, you need to help them. And also learn some of the things that you have to unlearn. You know, there are times when you have to unlearn certain things they've learned, which I also did because I didn't know what was going on in my life. And I had to unlearn the fact that I'm not a cross-dresser. It's not a dressing issue that I'm going through. I'm going through a gender identity issue. And I tried to unlearn a lot of things because I was in denial, right? I didn't want to be this way. So I had to unlearn some of this and say that if I'm born this way, then how can I make a change and an impact in the community being who I am? And that's what made a big difference in my life.
And you're absolutely right. Those things around LGBT youth, social construct of gender allyship, those are all the things that we're going to be talking about. But while we're still on this topic of global experiences, from your very personal experience and also the professional work that you've done, what does it mean being transgender in, say, India versus US or versus any other country today? Is there a place, you know, the perfect place for a transgender person to be today, where you are accepted and maybe the policy works in your favor, the community is more open than anywhere else?
That is an amazing question. It's a $1 million question, which I'm still thinking about in various ways. Because the reason I'm saying that is a lot of narratives that we have in English in this country, you don't have it in India. You don't have a terminology for gender non-binary. You don't have a terminology for gender dysphoria in India. And we're trying to find those narratives in India where the doctors and the families can actually understand. If you're gender queer, you don't have a terminology for that. And you don't have it in the local language. So it's so important to have those languages being translated in the right medical way that people across, if you're in Philippines, if you're in Netherlands, you know, or if you're in, let's say, in Spain or any other country where people are speaking different languages, you want to make sure certain words which are really important are being translated across the world. Now, having said that, I just want to come back to your question on the transgender community. The bottom line is, in this, as I was mentioning earlier, everybody in this world are different. You know, we have so many people, our thumbprints are different. And when you look at it that way, I think the most important element that we need to understand about the trans community is if you don't identify in the gender you are born, you're called as a transgender, or you are known as a cisgender, which is you identify in the gender you're born. Now, having said that and having established the fact of, you know, what is a transgender, I want to go into the next category within the transgender community where you have pre-op, post-op, and non-op transgender. So the post-op transgender are people who have had surgery, they're taking hormones, and they've completely transitioned medically. The pre-op transgender folks are probably taking HRT or getting prepared for an operation. That's what they call pre-op transgender. There are a lot of people who fall into this non-op transgender community where they don't want to have a medical transition because they don't see a need for it. They may have socially transitioned. They can be living the life in the society as a trans person, but they're medically not transitioned. I know a lot of friends today who are living that way. And I belong to the non-op transgender community because I have not medically transitioned, but I've socially transitioned. People know me as Celia. But the interesting thing is this, I also did not transition from one gender to the other. I have kept both my genders. So I don't hate my birth gender, but I have my birth gender and I also have my preferred gender, or I would call this as a chosen gender with the Celia. So Daniels is one of my, my birth gender and Celia is my preferred gender. And the more and more I grew, started getting old, I started feeling that this is the life that I was always ashamed of. You know, Celia was the identity that I was hiding all through my life. More than 47 years. And I felt like I need to amplify Celia more. And that's why I started coming out at my workplace and my community and my home, my family. People are starting to notice me as a person who can have two genders. And that's how I started coming out. And when I did that, it made a lot of difference, especially in the youth community, gender non-binary community. 27% of the youth today in California identify as gender non-binary. In 2025, almost 75% of the workforce in US are going to be millennials. Now, millennials have a much different way of thinking, and they are so much into intersectional identities. It's no longer going to be just the white board and or the predominant Asian board in the tech com industry. It's all going to be an intersectional identity, and that's what I'm thinking about, and how do we make changes in that community. So the transgender word has never changed. The word or the person who is transgender, even then the person is in either Thailand, Philippines, or any country, anywhere across the globe, a transgender person is a transgender person. But the way the society has identified them is in different ways. For instance, in India, there is a Hijra community, which is completely, I would say, a very traditional, religious-based transgender community, and they're called the Hijras. And that was a culture which is almost like a 4,000-year-old culture. And they were known as Dasis. They were revered in the temple courts. And when the colonial government came into India, they took these people and said, these are men and they are dressed like women and they cannot be living in a society like this. It's either male or female. And so they brought in a lot of colonial concepts which were so binary, and they just threw it on the government and they enforced these laws and these policies, which kind of led them to go into hiding and begging and prostitution. So that's why a lot of Hijra community are living in the darkness because of that. And they started, now it's much better in India. But in my opinion, it's not just stopping there, because I don't identify as a Hijra person in India. I don't belong to a religious community in India, and I don't belong to, I'm not a sex worker, or I'm not a street performer. I'm an entrepreneur. I'm educated myself, but I have the same issue that they are going through, and the gender identity issues are both the same. So how can I make a difference in their life to educate them, to also help them, to educate the companies around to not look at them with a stigma, but to look at them with empathy and empowerment, that we can have more people like the Hijra community who can be entrepreneurs, who can be CEOs of company. And that's what we need to change the culture in India. And that's what we're trying to do. More and more my friend is trying to do. And a lot of organizations and a lot of companies in India have started identifying that. Because India is now coming to a point where they're realizing that it's not always male to female, but there are female to male as well. There are people who are gender fluid, gender non-binary, gender neutral, gender queer. There are folks who are very different. So now they are getting to identify more in the gender spectrum. The sexual orientation spectrum was kept on a hold with a law called 377, which actually criminalized people who have same-sex relationships in India. And that was being decriminalized recently. So the lesbian and gay community and the bi community could actually come out and live their life the way they wanted to. But this was such a big stigma in India. And yeah, of course, in the Native American community, you have close to 5 genders. So gender is not always binary. That's the social constructs that people have put in. And when you even look at the binary, you start amplifying more about the patriarchy and say, you know, this is how it is. Founding fathers, you know, the presidents of the United States have always been men. You can never have women there because women are not capable. Why? You have created these binaries. We need to get out of this binary mindset, which will also help them amplify, even within the women community. If you see, the white women are getting more salaries than the black women or the Asian women. Why is that? So there is a lot of disparity within even the gender binaries. So now the companies are thinking, oh, it's not just male and female, but there are other issues also within the same category. Even if it's male, it's not always white. Right, we need to change all these ideas and the notion that color, class, race, gender, sexuality, these are not the deciding factors of the human welfare, human wellness. So it's so important for us to change these social constructs in such a way that it has to be accepting. You know, the companies cannot always have people who are of the same ethnicity in the board. You need to have a mixed culture. And that's what so important. So transgender community, when you look across the world, I have an interesting parallel that I wanted to also bring up is in India, the transgender community actually helped the LGB community to come out in India. Because though the cultures were already there, though the mythologies, though the Hindu gods were so gender fluid, and there was so much of same-sex relationships, even in Indian mythology, it wasn't amplified. The transgender community, and that was the only portion that was amplified. So the trans community kind of was a vehicle for helping the gay and lesbian community to come out to the open. So it really helped them in coming out. In US, the parallel is this way. The during Stonewall riots, you always had, it was all about the gay community. And the genderqueer community was, at the time, they were just part of it, but they were not amplified. Like Sylvia Rivera and, Marsha P. Johnson, they all fought for the rights. But, only now people are saying that, hey, they were all there and they fought against the police in 1969 during the Stonewall riots, not only in New York, but also in San Francisco and other places. Because this culture, this history, was not just based upon one particular gender identity or sexual orientation. But when I actually look at it, it's so beautiful that the LGBTQ community have to work with each other. It's not that the gay community is very good or the trans community is better. You have to work together. And sometimes the pansexual community is not even identified. In the bisexual community is not even in the... They all feel like they're left off somewhere. So it's so important for us to hold within the LGBTQ community and help each other. And that's what I started doing. You know, in my Stonewall, I'm the vice president of Stonewall Democrats in my county. And it's so important for me to have that kind of a culture even within Stonewall Democrats board. So I'm in the board and I made sure that we have a diverse board, not just all trans people. You know, we need to have gay, lesbian representation and also trans representation in these boards. So just to answer to your question, I think I went a long way to explain about the trans and transgender across the world. And it's a huge ocean, I would say. You know, there's so much that's evolving. And it's just, I would say that the history is repeating itself, that people are noticing now more. And this is not new. This has always been there. It's just that, oh, my eyes are open now. I see you. That's the kind of thing that's happening in the world today.
Thank you so much for joining us today. And I hope Celia's story has resonated and given you some things to reflect on and perhaps appreciate your privilege in certain intersections more. Next week, Celia and I will come back and we'll take this topic further by discussing LGBTQ youth, government policy, and give some very practical advice to businesses and organizations to build more inclusive cultures. Once again, if you found any of the aspects of this conversation upsetting or triggering past trauma, please tap into the show notes for some useful resources. There you will also find Celia's details to connect with her personally. For now, stay safe, look after yourself, and until next week.